Well, hello. This is the BrianMadden.com podcast, number 144, I believe. We're actually recording this on Tuesday, October 29th. So for this podcast today, I'm joined for the third or fourth time on the podcast by Russ Moore. Russ, hello. How are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks, Jack.
The other exciting thing today is that we have Jason Baton on. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing all right. Yeah.
Well, great. Well, and Jason, it's so exciting to have you on the show because, well, first of all, this is we're talking to each other over the Hangouts, and this is the first time that we've spoken face to face. I think by now, a lot of people in the enterprise mobility management community, they know your name, they know your face, they know your website. Since this is your first time on the show and this is our first time talking together, why don't you give us your introduction of how you got into Android management, how you got into EMM, and you can even go back a little ways and how you got into IT to begin with.
Sure. I started out in sort of like the first line call center stuff, I guess, as a lot of people do coming out of school and college and everywhere else, and sort of slowly built my way up from there. I started out while I was traveling about in Europe, and when I came back to the UK, I landed in a sort of disaster recovery compliance type role in the same company where we're rolling out tablets for field use, going out to different stores and tracking locations of products and things. It was a bit of a marketing effort. And they had no way of managing these devices, so they would send them out pre-configured internally. And it dawned on somebody that having some way of managing the devices would make sense. And given that nobody else in the company had any experience with Android at the time, and I'd sort of been dabbling for many years, since Android came out back in 2008, they wrote me into sort of saying, you know the product, you can probably figure out how to manage these based on what you're doing. See what you can do. And that's effectively where it started. So from there, pushing Samsung tablets out with device admin level management and all the hokey pokey stuff that we had to do to get them to do what we wanted them to do back then, has slowly sort of progressed into working for carriers and working for MSPs and building on that experience to the point where I was talking to guys like Russ in MobileIron and VMware, IBM, and everything else sort of on a weekly basis with different customers and that around the place. I'm not sure exactly. It was somewhere maybe three. No, it wouldn't have been. It's probably about 5 years now. Time is flying. That I sort of got into the whole device admin versus Android or Android for work as it was back then, and that interested me for a while, but it was still very, very immature, so I didn't think much of it. But as things have progressed to a couple of years ago, I mean, 6 was still a little bit iffy, but 7 and onwards, I really started to push all of my attention on Android Enterprise, particularly seeing that there was no real good documentation or understanding in the market outside of some sort of Google developer-focused documents that they tend to put out. As I turned my focus to that, started testing, documenting, and generally just getting to grips with the solution. I've been there now since it's transformed into Android Enterprise and to where it is today.
Yeah, well, that's quite a background, and I think the documentation also is something that I noticed, because you're right. You mentioned that you go to Google and you get some developer-facing documentation of the APIs, whether we're talking device admin APIs or Android Enterprise APIs, and an enterprise IT admin is probably looking at these and thinking, wait, what can I actually do and not do with this device?
Yeah, exactly. For an IT guy, it makes sense. And obviously, if it didn't, then I wouldn't have got into it to begin with. But the way I looked at it was, if I've got to sell this to other companies, other organizations or anything else, it's the CIOs or the C-levels, IT managers, and all of those sort of stakeholders that maybe don't necessarily understand the nitty-gritties of what an API does or doesn't do, and how I can then target that documentation in a way that explains it so that they would understand it, so they get it, and then tell their people to get on with the implementation and crack on that way.
Can I just say, like, I think what you've done is really important, Jason, because there's been just so much confusion out there about how to manage Android. And I don't think Google has done themselves any favors by calling things what they've called them and by, you know, changing the names of things and kind of moving the cheese all around a little bit. And so, you know, it was called Android for Work before. Now it's Android Enterprise. You have things called Google Play accounts and manage Google Play accounts. And what's the difference? And there was just so much confusion. And what you did was kind of shine some light on what was happening there and made it easier for enterprises to start actually using this stuff. So I think what you've done is actually really important and really helped Google out quite a bit, for sure.
Oh, thank you very much. But I mean, even to the degree of whether the E in enterprise is uppercase or lowercase.
Oh, yeah.
we had that conversation over a long period. And I think I've spoken to you as well as many other people about it directly, whether or not, you know, but that's what we were dealing with. And I mean, the amount of names just for Cope, you know, the fully managed devices with work profiles, or work profiles on fully managed devices as it is now, and every other name they gave it as well. So it's been challenging. And even keeping on top of that sort of naming scheme, I remember going through at least 40 documents just changing from one name to another when something changed. But, you know, keeps me on my toes. It's it's a bit of fun when it's not, you know, wildly infuriating.
Okay, well, so here's our first question that's not on the outline, but here we are talking about the difficulties dealing with just the different naming conventions, among other things. It occurs to me like sometimes, okay, you have people that have managed desktops and other systems for many years, and then they look at mobility management and they might think like, oh, mobility management, like it's just the phones, or it's different, or it's weird, or something. And but now we're at this point where like this stuff is actually pretty complicated, and you have to do it, and there's a lot to learn about it. I don't know what my point is here, but I guess as a mobility person, and I'm sure some of you, I'm sure you remember having these conversations occasionally when the phones were, especially like BYOD iPhones, they were looked as like, okay, someone's trying to get our enterprise data on this overgrown MP3 player. But look at us now.
We come a long way. You know, to that point, I think if you just look at the Android journey from what the way that they used to be managed with Device Admin, which came out around Froyo or slightly before that, speaking of names, I think that's Android 2.1 or 2.2.
2.2, yeah.
That's about when we started managing Android devices back in 2010, and it was very rudimentary at the time, right? You had an app that you deployed to an Android device. It gave you some control over the device. Like, you could wipe the device. You could push down a Wi-Fi profile, you know, email, some apps, rudimentary apps, although you couldn't install them silently. So lots of challenges. And over the years, Google, you know, you have to give them credit. They've really addressed a lot of that. All of that stuff has just become so much easier. But I forget what the point was.
But. That's okay. Well, so the point is, this is a podcast today. We're obviously here. I didn't mention it at the very top of the introduction, but we're here to talk about the state of Android Enterprise. Obviously, Android 10 just came out recently, and we're going to be coming up on it. Was Jason, I know you'll be able to correct me on the dates, but I think I remember it was like June or July 2014 when I remember it was one of the Google conferences, when I believe it was Sundar Pichai was speaking in the keynote and talking, and like, we're going to do this Android Work thing, because even then it was Android Work before it was Android for Work. Mm-hmm. And of course, like you said, it took a couple versions for it to be fully mature. But for today, I mean, I think like it's been a couple of years now that everyone that I've been speaking to on this subject agrees, like, okay, this has been done right. Can you think of any like major gaps now that you think like, oh, Google and Android is really missing this and we could really use this feature, or have they got all the big things covered? What do you think, Jason?
Blimey. So it'd be crazy to say that they've got everything covered, because I don't think they would have. Even, 5 years down the line, there's probably going to be some wild use case for some company somewhere that makes total sense, but, nobody's done it before. So what I'd say, and I think we've talked about this before as well, the idea of only having one work profile on a device is fine in principle, but if you're a contractor or a doctor or somebody who, goes around to several independent organizations, you're severely limited to only the first work profile that you put on that device. And as I say, we've discussed this before, I think in a decent amount of detail, but that to me is one of the biggest challenges, I think, for the contractors and for the folks who rely on multiple independent EMMs to manage the corporate data coming from these different organizations. And I know there's probably ways and means about it, but having a work profile per organization or support for multiple work profiles on a device, I think, is one of the most challenging, for sure, because, integrating one work profile is hard enough for Google, I'm sure, but adding more onto that is going to convolute it even further. But that's always been on one of the highest priorities of, or maybe not priority, but it's the highest on my wish list for support for Android Enterprise, just because that is a big segment of the market, and I think that would help a lot of people.
Yeah, always. I agree as well. And I want to talk a little bit more about the work profiles and that issue in particular a little bit later. But first, also, I had top on my list to talk today to talk about Android Enterprise adoption. So, like as I was saying, we've had it for about 5 years. And in the old days, when we would talk about Android Enterprise adoption, it sort of meant like, well, has this organization switched their deployment over from device admin to Android Enterprise agent? But now that device admin is deprecated, obviously, for a new device that you're going to be enrolling today or a new EMM deployment that you're going to be putting out, there is no question of what you're going to do. You're just going to do Android Enterprise. You're not going to use device administrator, although maybe you'll have some counterexamples of that, which I'd like to hear. But let's break this down into a few questions. So when it comes to changing over existing deployments from device admin to Android Enterprise, how are we doing? I mean, obviously, like I said, new deployments, they'll start out AE, but there are obviously a lot of devices out there that are going to have to either be migrated or just transition by attrition. So, Jason, where are we today?
So I'd say we're still very, very low in reality compared to where we need to be. I know I'm in a little bit of a bubble surrounded by people and organizations that are doing Android Enterprise because they're the sort of folks that I would speak to anyway. But in reality, I think there are a significant number of organizations out in the wild that A, don't know what Android Enterprise is yet, B, have never considered that there's going to be a migration and they don't know anything about the deprecation, and C, I've lost my train of thought, but
well, that's okay. And these are organizations that they're managing Android devices today. They probably have some EMM in place. I mean, if they have some EMM in place, wouldn't their friendly SE be inviting them to device admin deprecation webinars and things like that?
Well, you'd think so. And to say that they're not, it would be obviously a lie, because the Mobile Irons, the VMwares and the IBMs and SOTYs and everywhere, if you follow the marketing channels and you sign up for their updates and stuff, then you see that come into your inbox. But you're also looking at a lot of SMBs to mid-sized organizations who'll just, they'll get their Mobile Iron licenses from a partner who may or may not care that much about what they're ultimately doing once they've got their license commission or whatever, and just leave them to it. So, of course, EMMs are doing what they can. They're providing updates. They're sending details out. But that doesn't mean that the organizations out in the wild there are going to be seeing that and therefore necessarily going to be aware of anything that's going on.
You know, that's a really good point. And I think like this underlines like a really big issue that we see out there with a lot of our customers, in that they approach mobile management the way they have desktop management sometimes. And desktop, you know, desktop OSs don't change as much as mobile OSs.
Well, we're in an interesting period of time for that, aren't we? I guess here again, there's probably the dividing line between organizations that are just realizing that, oh, officially they only have like three more months of left of support on Windows 7. You know, those SMBs versus those organizations that are really struggling to figure out what the heck they're going to do with Windows 10 updates, as well as are they going to do them as often as Microsoft wants? And Microsoft itself is obviously trying to figure out what they're doing with this.
As usual, you can pay, though. If you want to stay on Windows 7, you can pay for these extended support contracts. And
oh, but I think by now it gets very expensive.
It gets very, very expensive.
Even if you're not paying for it, I mean, I still see instances of XP kicking about while I'm out and about different places. So nothing to say that Windows 7 won't still be there in the, you know, 10 years from now.
So the bottom line is that not everybody like us spends every day on Twitter and social media talking about the latest device management APIs and everything like that. And so, Jason, you're saying, and Russ, it sounds like you agree that we really are in very early days of just people using the AE API as opposed to the device admin API.
Yeah, for existing deployments, for greenfield deployments, for people that are just getting into Android management, they're using Android Enterprise. You don't even have to have that conversation with them, which is, there was an old way to manage Android. Don't worry about that. We're using this new way. They only know Android Enterprise. But for a lot of our customers that have been deploying Android for 10 years or so, they're still dipping their feet in. If I look at our products at Mobile Iron, we have a premises-based product called Core. That's where a lot of our legacy customers are, like customers that have been Mobile Iron customers for a long time. And then newer people tend to buy the cloud product. On the cloud product, I can see that we're like in the high 70% adoption rate.
Oh, cool. And is that actual, like Mobile Iron can look at the like aggregated metrics of the customers and see that?
I have aggregated data for all of our cloud clusters. And I can see that the numbers are around there for Android Enterprise.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure the numbers aren't the same for Core, right?
No. And Core has been going for quite a significant amount of time longer, hasn't it?
Exactly. And these you know, they have migration projects. So they're dipping their feet in. I have one large hospital in New York City that I was talking to, and they didn't know that device admin was being deprecated, despite the fact that we try and bombard them with that information. And they heard from Epic. So Epic makes, you know, the most popular apps for hospitals, MyChart Bedside and a couple others. And Epic said, hey, your stuff might break with Android 10. And so we got an irate email saying, what? We had to kind of educate them a little bit about, you know, what was being deprecated in Android 10.
Okay, yeah, and we should talk about that in a second when we talk about the features in 10. So, but Russ, you also mentioned greenfield customers, which of course the other half of the Android Enterprise adoption question is really just the are we officially supporting Android question, because we can easily say that any organization bigger than one or two people probably has some Android users in it. And that's 100% of organizations, schools, businesses, whatever in the world. But the number of them that are worldwide are actually have, number one, some sort of enterprise mobility management deployment, or at least have given some thought to that, of course, is a lesser number. And unfortunately, for better or worse, the number of those organizations that say, okay, we are officially managing and supporting Android in some way is yet a subset of that number. So these are like huge numbers. And of course, it differs in different regions in North America versus APAC and EMEA, which we should also side note. We're doing this podcast from San Francisco. Russ is in New York and Jason is somewhere in Wales, correct? Mm-hmm. And so and this is where these numbers are like so big and so broad that it's kind of hard to put the number on it. But in terms of like adoption in the total addressable market, where are we for Android support numbers? Jason, are you what are you seeing over there?
So I don't necessarily have market figures. What I can go on is what Google say. And I think Google mentioned it a few times in the past. Of the entire market, I think they suggest that only about 35-ish% of devices are under management today, which leaves a staggering amount of business to be grasped from thin air. And of that, of course, Android Enterprise is a much smaller number again, because although it's been out for 5 years, you know, there is still that, obviously, the security perceptions that people have about Android generally, but also the fact that people don't know the difference or don't know of Android Enterprise itself. And it's only the work that the EMMs and the MSPs and you know, some carriers as well, I suppose, do to promote it and take it forward.
And Russ, what like figures do you ballpark and throw around?
Well, from a BYOD standpoint, we definitely do have customers that have just haven't done Android, or if they've done Android, they've done like, you can do Android, but you have to use, you know, the Pixel 3 or the Pixel 4 or the Samsung S10, right? They limit it to devices that they know and have tested, or they might even use Android Enterprise recommended. So, but that's not actually where we're investing in MobileIron as a company. There's definitely, I think, opportunities there, but where we see the biggest opportunity is in Task Worker. So we've been beefing up our capabilities around how do you deploy Android in a factory or, you know, to a large workforce that, you know, needs to use a kiosk or something similar to a kiosk, might need to do multi-user. Jason mentioned before, that's been a big issue. So we've been developing solutions that make it easier to do multi-user in a kiosk. That's where we think the biggest market to unlock is today.
And that's where we see devices like Zebra, Honeywell, other things. You two can tell me better. But it's we're looking beyond the Pixels, beyond the Samsungs. It's other OEMs.
Yeah, it might be, but it also might be like, you know, very low-cost tablets, Kyocera or something like that. We see a lot of that in Latin America, for example. Even in the U.S., you know, certain carriers have a low-cost alternative, usually, you know, from a Chinese or Korean manufacturer for a tablet. So we see it on those as well, even, you know, with a hardened case, but also the Sonims, the Zebras, the Honeywells of the world. Yeah.
Is this category of OEMs, are they generally, you know, back in the day, it used to be some of them would do custom management APIs. Some of them, you weren't really sure what type of modifications that would be coming in on the device. Sometimes it could be unpredictable, but are they all now tending to do Android Enterprise according to the specifications and OEM config and zero touch enrollment? Is that world starting to get neater and more orderly?
Yeah. And maybe Jason wants to comment too, but look, we've seen Honeywell launch their OEM config app. Zebra has now got one. Samsung was second to market after Sony, who for some reason pulled their OEM config app. We see a bunch of those, but I don't know. Jason, what are you seeing?
I still think it's a little bit Wild West, the big ones for sure. As you say, the Zebras, the Honeywells, and other OEM, even some rugged Samsung stuff, that's fine. But there are still an exorbitant amount of OEMs that come from various parts of the world that still focus very much on AOSP. They'll have their own integrated management solutions and sort of sell the devices with that sort of bundled in. Although it is getting better, and there seems to be a lot more noise coming from these lesser known OEMs, I think there's still a fair amount of work to go compared to the consumer OEMs that we're used to seeing on the streets.
We should probably define AOSP and OEM config for some of our listeners that might not know what those are. So why don't you take a stab at AOSP and I'll...
Oh, yeah, sure. So AOSP is the Android open source project. It's the source code to Android, and everything that comes before you certify with Google for GMS, so Google's mobile services. So you can build a device from source, and you can put it onto, you can build an OS from source, put it onto a device that you're building. But unless it's GMS certified, it's gone through the certifications, and you become a partner of Google and Android, then that is still considered an AOSP device. And it's, in fact, it's not officially supported for things like Android Enterprise, amongst other things within that GMS license.
And these days, if a consumer were to pick up one of these devices, maybe it's the tablets that you would find in Walmart or Tesco, the ones that are in the consumer market may be heavily skinned, or if you're sort of used to GMS certified devices. And these days, the delta between a GMS certified device and a device that just AOSP is pretty big, right?
Yeah. So you wouldn't have access to any of the normal Google services. No YouTube, no Google Play Store. Folks, whether they're technical or not, have probably been following the debacle with Huawei over the last few months. And it's a big deal. If you lose that license and you can't ship a device with Google services, you lose the entire app ecosystem. I mean, it's still an Android device, so you have ways and means of getting the apps that you know and love on the device regardless. But it's not that seamless experience that the people usually are more inclined to pay for. And you also lose things, as say, with Google service like Play Protect and other things that are constantly scanning those apps wherever you source them from for malware and other sort of potentially harmful tendencies. And without that, then it's a little bit like going to the Wild West and just pulling down what you can, hoping for the best. I've written articles about why you shouldn't install apps from unknown sources, for example, and that is very much a GMS-focused article, because if you're not a GMS certified device and you're AOSP, that's effectively all you can do. Source your APK files, install them directly, and hope for the best.
Well, let's talk about the security side a little bit. So I had that a lot of, you know, I'd see in our community, in the EMM community, I think there's a lot of us. I've seen all sorts of Twitter posts and LinkedIn posts sort of like busting through the FUD about Android security, because there is a lot of outdated conventional knowledge about the security level of Android. And if we're talking BYOD enterprise level devices, it's something that, you know, it's a Samsung, it's a Pixel, it's one of these devices. I mean, it's very good today, but there's of course some enterprises are still not quite at that point. So what are the big, I guess there are still a lot of big misconceptions that probably outdated for these higher level devices. What are you seeing, and what comes up most often? What are the things that make you want to like go and write a LinkedIn post and be like, no, this is the way it is?
The general perception that Android devices aren't secure, and that is a blanket statement without, you know, any further fact finding or any further consideration of the multiple parts and aspects of an Android device generally. So that's the most frustrating thing, because then you dismiss that whole operating system in one sweep of the brush, you know? And I find that frustrating, because I think over the last 2 years, Gartner has said that the Android tops for security controls over iOS and every other mobile. But, you know, just assuming that if you pick an Android device up and bring it into work, that you immediately, you know, put that whole company at risk is crazy. But that's the perception that some organizations hold for whatever reason. And part of that, sure, is because there are still organizations out there today that are running Android 4.4.4 devices on rugged kit, and they don't see any of the benefit over the last sort of 5-6 years of Android development. But the rest of folks, it's just, well, I heard it, or I saw it on the internet, or there was a malware scare on, you know, whatever website. So I'm not going to touch Android at all because it's not secure.
Oh yeah, don't even get me started on the malware scares where it turns out it was, you know, you would have had to be downloading from unknown sources and had other features for it to even affect anything. And I just want to write a there's that book like How to Lie with Statistics. I want to write the article that's like How to Lie about Security Threats. But anyway, so one of the stories that begun to be disseminated among popular knowledge is that Android devices, some of them, the carriers may not push out OS updates as fast, but in every subsequent version of Android, Google has been compartmentalizing and making more of the features available in apps that can be updated directly from Google Play. So even if the operating system is not updated or slow to update, all those GMS apps are being updated much more frequently. So you have a fresher phone. But I'm wondering with Android Enterprise, to get sort of the latest features, you are still a bit more dependent on when you're actually getting that full OS update. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is ultimately. If you look at the big versions over the last few years, you know, 7, Android 7 introduced, it wasn't file-based encryption, it was, but 8 introduced zero touch, 9 has introduced ephemeral users. So although they will now and again very rarely push things back through like a Google Play Services update, as they did with blocking unknown sources, cross-device, for example. That was a temporary fix. It was, it worked, but it wasn't necessarily what it should have been. And that's now officially launched with 10. Everything else, when you look at the different versions of Android, they have their highlight mainline features. Oh, I said mainline then because I was thinking of Project Mainline. They have their main features. And the approach now, I think, of things like Project Mainline and everything else they're sort of working to compartmentalize is probably only a good thing because, as you rightly allude to, the more they compartmentalize, the easier it is to update things. And who knows, that might lead to more features that could be pushed out in a sub update rather than waiting for a full version.
And we should also mention, so it's been a few years now that Google has been talking about Project Treble, which was one project to make doing updates easier for the OEMs and carriers, and Project Mainline is again another project to break more of the operating system into apps that can easily be updated. So these are two effects that are ongoing now. And the other thing that I should mention as well is that aside from the app updates, is that another thing about Android is that these monthly and quarterly security bulletins are going out as well. So even though the operating system itself might not be updating to the next dot release, these monthly security bulletins, they are being applied to the operating system at that level. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I mean, arguably, that is more important than the big updates, because you can pick up an Android 7 device that won't get Android 8 or Android 9 for whatever reason, but they can still be effectively supported and kept secure for the full 3 whatever years that the OEM decides to do. So there are plenty of examples out in the wild where, for whatever reason, an OEM won't push the latest version. They won't upgrade from 8 to 9, for example, and they maybe won't upgrade to 10 now on their 9 devices for whatever reason. Maybe they've already done an update once or anything else. But particularly if they're part of Android Enterprise Recommended or the Android One program, the latter requiring an update every 30 days, a security update every 30 days, whereas the former requires one within 90 days for 3 years, then you can say, I'm going to pick up this phone today. It's going to be supported, for the 3 years. Even if I don't get a new OS version, all the vulnerabilities and all the other nasties that need to be patched will be patched and my device remains secure. And I mean, that ties in a little bit back to one of the earlier questions in saying that, Android devices are running outdated versions of the OS, they're not secure, we're not going to use them in business. Well, if they're within their 3-year life cycle and they're still getting security updates, then there's nothing to say that they are not secure devices.
So for a consumer, three years, you know, if a consumer were assuming that they're maybe on a 2.5 to maybe 1.5 year replacement cycle if they really like getting devices quickly. But for a device that's going to be a ruggedized device for these frontline use cases, is 3 years of support enough? I thought I remembered a few years back seeing something about, was it Zebra maybe doing Zebra, some extended updates?
Samsung Enterprise as well.
Yeah, I, if I'm having an Android-powered barcode scanner, is there anybody out there that's going to be doing updates that's going to let me use this device for 5 or 6 years? Or is it more of a thing that's, okay, we like take the, it should be a phone and sled thing so that the phone can be the cheap part that we upgrade and the expensive rugged sled with the specialized scanning hardware maybe lasts 7 or 8 years while we swap out the phones. What's the strategy for those longer term rugged devices out there?
I want to say stay tuned for Mobile Iron, because there's actually an announcement that's about to happen around that. And Samsung kind of paved the way, right, with eFOTA enterprise firmware over the air, where you could deploy updates to their higher end devices that ran Knox firmware. And Zebra has got something similar. So some EMMs, I'm sure, are going to do integrations to that. What's not clear to me today is that I know that, you know, there are still some issues where carriers can gate those upgrades. Like Samsung eFOTA, I know for sure that there were some issues around that where the carrier just won't allow that enterprise update to happen. And we really should say, like, we spent a lot of time talking about how, you know, monthly or quarterly security updates happen and stuff like that. A lot of those are still gated by the carriers. You're not always going to get those, because those are still going through the operators' testing teams before they release them. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges Android has had that Apple, quite frankly, doesn't have, because they have 100% total control over when the devices are going to update. That's still not the case on Android, and I think that's one of the bigger challenges.
Yeah.
If I'm wanting to do a deployment in my factory or to my frontline users, what's the strategy there? Would going with like an enterprise-oriented MVNO be the answer, or is that still gated through the parent carrier? Like, what am I thinking here for my like 5-year strategy?
So at least in Europe, in more recent years, I've been seeing a lot of disconnects between devices and data, or, you know, SIM services. So where you source your Android devices doesn't necessarily need to be the same person, company, carrier, whatever, that you source your SIM cards through. That's becoming increasingly popular, I think, and I'm personally in favor of it. I think the same thing I've said for multiple years is, if you can, don't get the devices through your carrier unless they are worldwide unlocked versions of the OS, of the software. Some carriers do that, some carriers don't. But ultimately, if you go for a SIM-locked carrier version of the device that you're going through, you're going to run into the issues that Russ has touched on. And as frustrating as it is, I mean, things like Project Mainline may improve that to some degree, but until Google take proper control over the updates, which, I mean, at this point, we don't know if that ever will fully come to fruition in the same way that Apple do, then any alternative to getting a device that's carrier locked and stuck on O2 or Telefonica or a Vodafone or anything else version of that software that's locked down to what they do and when they do it is, something ideally to be avoided.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So does that mean, if I do this route of buying directly from the OEM or the OEM's distributor, does that mean, are the updates then only coming through the OEM and I don't have to worry about whether or not the carrier adding another step in the process?
I mean, I think that's the idea of it, and that's probably one of the benefits of going for these sort of worldwide, fully open software images on the devices. So you sidestep any issues that a carrier may cause by being in the middle of that.
So to clarify, is this something that carriers can do today and get, or I'm sorry, that customers can do today and then can get updates directly from the OEM without them going through the carrier?
I mean, most of the devices I've got in front of me are SIM and locked that have been sourced from wherever they're sourced from. Some of them have been sourced from carriers that are unlocked and not locked down with a carrier image. Most of them are Amazon or anywhere else they come from. And they get updates directly from the ODM, not the ODM, sorry, the OEM or wherever, whatever update software they're using.
Okay, great. And Rusta, do you have a bit to add there?
One thing I want to say is that I'm pretty sure I heard Google talking about Android 10, that they were providing some new ways to update devices that it seems like you could kind of stage them in a factory by staging the Android code on a server and doing local updates. Jason, have you seen this?
Yes, but that still relies on when whoever releases their software to you releases their software. So if it's carrier devices, then you've got to wait for the carrier to make that image available from whatever software update server that they're making it available to. Once you get it, though, that is a massively important feature, I think, particularly for warehouses and logistics and everywhere where you don't necessarily have a direct access to the internet, but you have private networks that you can push updates to.
Okay, well, this is certainly the ongoing and developing issue of our time, and not just in Android, but in all operating systems. I mean, we are in the midst of the transitioning of the days of you buy hardware, you put your image on it, you run that image as long as you want and do whatever you want to it, to there are other parties in control now. So sort of certainly among all of the operating systems, some bigger issues that are bigger than Android, bigger than we can figure out how to solve on the podcast today. The next big issue that is on the top of everybody's mind is privacy. And this is both from a BYOD perspective and from a general user perspective. In Android, it was great to see over the last couple of versions all of the different runtime permissions, and now in Android 10, the permissions for photos and video and audio and location and everything are getting much more granular, which I think we're probably all pretty excited about that. But one of the first big milestones to talk about was when the whole concept of the work profile itself came out. There were a few precedents. Does anyone remember back in the day when there would be projects like, oh, VMware was talking about the mobile virtualization platform and to put like guest Android VMs on phones? And there were a couple of other manufacturers. Let's see, Cellrox is coming into mind right now. There were a few others. We would write all these articles about these people like, okay, so you take a Pixel, or I guess it was a Nexus back in the day, and we have this version of Android that's going to run two profiles or two copies side by side. But of course, with the advent of Android Enterprise, we got this all built directly into Android and coming in a much more official way. And, you know, many, many years before the other mobile operating system got that anything close to that level of work and personal separation built in. So work profiles, obviously, I'm a fan. For those listening at home, let's remind our listeners, what can an admin see and not see on a BYO device that's managed using a work profile? Russ, do you want to take this one?
By default, they can't see very much. When you create this little, what a lot of people refer to as a container, what Google likes to call a profile, when you have these apps that have a little work badge on them, they have a little suitcase on them, they, by default, they can't share data with other personal apps, right? Which is what a lot of mobile admins are concerned with. And they also, up until Android 10, haven't been able to do things like have a unified address book, for example, because of those restrictions. But we can't see on a device like that what your personal apps are. The mobile admin can't see that. They can't see your text messages. They can't see your private photo collection. They don't know what kind of music you have on your device. All we're really aware of is what's inside that profile. And we can't wipe your device. We can only wipe that profile. We can only unlock that profile. So really, we are limited to having just this little bit of real estate on the device. It's got all the enterprise content. We can see some stuff around that, but we still can't do things like read your email from the device. You might be able to do that from Office 365 or somewhere else.
Yeah,
but
yeah, that's the one that you always need to remind people of, that IT has other ways of reading your corporate email.
Yes, but that's what we can see. We can see that little piece of real estate on the device and nothing else, you know, besides some maybe the IMEI and some other information about the device.
And it seems today like the biggest thing is, so of course, Jason, as you were mentioning earlier, blocking sideloaded apps on the personal side of the phone is one thing that you can do with a work profile in Android 10.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of them. It's also, I think, worth selling it a little bit to the IT admins out there as well, that you can sort of enforce basic security if you've got a work profile enabled phone. So you can set pins or passcode requirements, and you can sort of enforce, as you say, and as I say from you earlier on, the fact that you can't install apps from unknown sources. So you can make sure that there's a little bit of security on the device as a whole before you let it come into your network or your environment and put your corporate data into a work profile. That also extends to device posture, so you can tell if a device has been rooted, whether you're a work profile or not. And you know, if there's any network threats, you can detect those as well. So from a user perspective, super good for privacy. You can ensure that organizations aren't snooping on your personal data. And from an organization's perspective, the IT admin, you can make sure that device is secure, the device has a basic device posture in place to ensure that it's safe to come onto your networks.
So here's a question that I want to ask both of you. We're early in our device admin to Android Enterprise transition days. So the total number of BYOD users that are actually using work profiles in production, we're probably talking this is pretty early. And again, this is something that we're assuming that the total addressable market is probably big, especially if we ever someday get multiple work profiles on a device, then that opens up a whole bunch of new use cases as well around contractors and gig workers. But the question is, as these companies, customers finally do start rolling out work profiles, we can sit here and talk about it's academically, and you know, I like that you can turn the work profile off during the weekend, and I like knowing what IT can and can't do. But hey, we're here on a podcast having this conversation. We are not typical end users. So what are you seeing in terms of end users? Do they understand this when they see the badge with the briefcase, or when they get the email saying like, okay, here's what IT can and can't see? What are the experiences of customers that are deploying work profiles now?
So certainly when it was earlier on, back before we had the dedicated left for personal, right, the tabs in the app drawers and things, where the apps were just sort of bundled all together in the app drawer, with some of them with an icon, some not, there was an awful lot of confusion and a questioning constantly, like, why have I got two versions of the same app? You know, can I not just use one version and have, you know, whatever? As Google have gone and now, as I say, introduced things like the tabs drawer, where you can see that one is specifically personal and one is specifically work, they've taken the icons off the home screen, because they used to put them in, you know, in a folder on the home screen as well to collect them up. Having more of a visible separation, I think, has made everything ever so slightly easier. And of course, you know, with Android 10 now and the way they've revamped the onboarding process for creating work profiles that, you know, show you what you can and can't, or what can and can't be seen by IT, the difference between the personal and work apps and so on and so forth, I think that has made it a little bit clearer. But, you know, you're still going to get folks who don't quite see the use case for having two identical apps with one having a briefcase until maybe it's shown or better explained to them. I think Russ has probably got a lot more, you know, a lot more examples from Mobile Iron's perspective on how users and customers get on with it.
Yeah, Russ, actually, now I'm curious, does Mobile Iron ever like bring in what's the advertising term when they bring in like the test audience? It's like, hey, we're doing this employee facing app, so we need people that aren't experts in enterprise mobility. And it's like, Mobile Iron is in Silicon Valley. Like, where do you find the person on the street to do like the user testing? I'm suddenly now really curious how that works.
Well, the answer is like, if you asked me last week, I would say, I don't think we do that. But actually, I got an email last week saying, can you recruit some friends and family to look at this feature? It wasn't exactly the privacy feature, but we are actually doing some of that type of user testing. You know, regarding the whole privacy situation, like, do users know if they have an app with a little badge on it, or if they have a different drawer that says work on their device? I feel that, there's some confusion, but it's not like the confusion we see on Apple devices. Because on an Apple device, you know, a work app looks just like a personal app. And as a matter of fact, you might be using an app that you think is the personal app, but it could be a work app because it's silently managed. And I really think this whole privacy thing, it's so huge in Android 10. It's broken out and there's a new permission screen. Apple's building something called user enrollment that, you know, is sort of profile-ish, but doesn't have the visible icons. This is, you know, and if you watch Silicon Valley last night, the opener was, the CEO is in front of Congress talking about, you know, are we looking, you know, are we harvesting user data? So it's really just the zeitgeist of our time, isn't it? And we see both of the software developers, Apple and Google, just building a lot of these features into the OS. We've done it with our apps for a while at MobileIron, where when you enroll, you're told what we can and cannot see. And there's reminders here and there in the operating systems about what you can and cannot see. But for the most part, I felt like users would find out when they enrolled the device. And then they would forget. There was still paranoia. There were still two device carriers. And I think both of them are trying very hard to tackle this issue right now. It's bigger than just mobile device management or UEM for all of these guys.
Well, and also, I've grown a lot more pragmatic over the years, and I think carrying two devices is perfectly fine. Prior to work profiles and iOS user enrollment, you know, I think it's a question that I would have had to thought long and hard about. And even here in the Bay Area, you think, okay, everyone's very very advanced in their technology, and the number of people that I see on the bus or friends, or I'm out somewhere and I see a lot of people with two phones. And I can say like, oh, well, here's what you could do with a work profile, or if you're doing an apps only enrollment, or like, hey, ask your IT admin about this new user enrollment thing. Like that's all great. But I think two phones is also perfectly legitimate as well, especially when we're also seeing potential laws around freelancers and gig workers and contractors get more strict as well. So I think that'll be, I think it's fine. But so we've been talking for a little while now, but with any Android focused podcast, the fun thing that we get to talk about is the wide world of form factors and devices. You know, I've been following Samsung DeX closely, but of course now we have foldable phones, and you know, the experimentation is still widely out there. So what do you think is really cool and exciting? What do you think is ridiculous and a crazy idea? What do you want to get your hands on? Let's start with Jason.
So I think against the popular vote, I'm not that massively into the foldables. I don't know if you've seen the new Microsoft Surface lineup with the two screens instead of sort of one foldable screen. That is where my head is at the moment. That may change in future, but the whole seeing the crease down the middle of a screen that I want to use, that bugs me far more than having a small gap or a little bit of bezel or something. For some reason, I don't know. It's not necessarily logical, but it is what it is. It's also the fact that they're very fragile. They wouldn't hold up a week with the way I treat devices generally. And so maybe subconsciously I'm playing the safer bet. That said, things like the new Razer phone that's bringing back that flip form factor, I think that's cool. So I potentially lean more towards that than I would like a phone that folds out into a tablet. But I guess it depends on how it's done.
Like, aside from somebody might think, oh, this is cool, do you see potential enterprise use cases for any of these things?
I mean, there's always going to be, somebody is going to make the justification somewhere to say that this needs to be used in enterprise. I think people are generally better off going for devices designed for enterprise use than sort of just bringing in the newest things, as you know the C-levels often do. That, interestingly, I think, is how the whole iPhone thing took off in enterprise many, many years ago, wasn't it? C-levels got their iPhones and people decided they needed to be managed.
Russ, how about you? Anybody trying to deploy anything new and out of the box among your customers? Or is it like this is the consumer fun that we'll experiment with and see what happens?
Look, this is the reason for Android Enterprise, isn't it? Like you should be able to support any of these devices. They should work, you know, in theory, they should all work the same. Foldables, I just haven't heard that much about them yet. There's just been too many issues, I think, out the gate with these dual screen devices. It's really telling that Microsoft announced a device that isn't going to be available till the holiday season of 2020. So I think that they're trying to seed the market, build up developer support for the dual screen.
Well, yeah, and this is, we should clarify, so this is some sort of dual screen Android powered but heavily Microsoft integrated device that they announced a couple of weeks ago. Does anybody know if it supports Android Enterprise?
I assume it's got to. It's going to be...
If it's going to be GMS, we don't even know if it's going to be GMS yet, do we? Because it's only just sort of been hinted at in promotional stuff, but it'd be crazy, I think, if it wasn't GMS.
Yeah, I think hopefully by now Microsoft have learned their lesson on this, and
they could still do, they could do an Amazon and come out, you know, with the Microsoft equivalent of the Fire and see where that goes.
Yeah, and look at how well that worked out for Amazon.
But look at, you know, with such a big screen, I really have to question, like, did they get burned so badly in mobile that they don't think that they can run Windows 10 on this thing? Because it's really, you know, with that form factor, it's closer to the Surface tablet that they have today. So I don't know. I think it's one of the more interesting announcements I've heard Microsoft make recently. And Jack, as you mentioned, with the deeper integration into Office products, to me, it's about driving the cloud story, driving customers to start consuming more Office 365 services.
And that in itself is not necessarily a new thing, because they've been doing that with Samsung for a while anyway, haven't they? The Microsoft edition of the different Samsung devices.
Yeah, that can make sense. And you know, the last thing with these devices that I'll mention is that neither of you mentioned so far is Samsung DeX, which is of course where you dock the phone and it comes up in a full desktop UI. And I think when this concept first was put out there, which was first I remember hearing it was with the Motorola Atrix, so we're talking a while back, and they're sort of talking like, oh, the salesperson on the road, you just go into you just find a hot desk, or you plug this into your hotel TV, but then it's like, wait, okay, so I'm going to bring all of these cords and hope that there's like a TV or a display where I need it. Like, so that the business traveler just bringing their phone and plugging it into something, I think, is pretty ridiculous. And so for a while, I was pretty skeptical of this DeX idea. And of course, Microsoft was doing the same thing in the very waning end days of Windows 10 Mobile. However, I've kept up with Samsung, and they've introduced me to some customers that are in trial mode with DeX for use cases like public safety. And so I wrote up this one use case where they're replacing like probably over-specced ruggedized laptops in police cars with just a dock that you put the phone in. And considering that you can have like, okay, it's the same copy of the app, it's in the same state, you don't have to worry about anything syncing because you're just running the same app locally off the phone and things like that. That use case, that made a lot of sense. So, you know, I don't know if DeX started out as some sort of moonshot project for Samsung or something, but this one seems like it's panning out for use cases like that and could actually become a thing. So that's pretty interesting. Russ, have you seen any customers interested in this talk about DeX in use cases like that?
To be honest, not very often. You know, there's some stuff, and you know, we were talking about OEM config before. That's a way with Android Enterprise to configure a device over the air. I've seen a lot of hooks for DeX in there. So that extends capabilities to Mobile Iron to actually do some more advanced DeX configurations. But the way we've been approaching this is we really think that as opposed to like putting your device in a cradle and having it light up a CRT, essentially, we've been looking at using the device as your identity so that if you were to go over to, for example, you had Chrome OS in the police car or something like that, you would use your device as the identity and you would be able to get into the cloud services or the services that you had behind the firewall to access the data that you needed. And it, so it wouldn't have to be Dex. It could be anything that had any connectivity. And that's kind of how we've been approaching it. And that's where we've seen it going with some of our customers.
Right. Yeah. I've had conversations with Mobile Iron about that as well. And that's been, that's another whole topic that we could talk about is FIDO certification in Android phones. I actually have, I have a whole bunch of additional thoughts and other questions that we didn't get to today, but we're running pretty long and we're running close to the end of our scheduled time. So with that, I think it's time for us to wrap up. This has been super fun, Jason. It was great to talk to you in person. Oh, the other thing that we could talk about is like tuba and sousaphone and bass trombone playing.
Yeah, we missed all of that today, didn't we?
So I think all of you are pretty easy to find on the web.
I try to keep a low profile.
Yeah. Let's see. We can find you mostly at baton.org. Mm-hmm. I'll also plug the Mobile Pros Slack group. Oh, also, you started a new job recently as well. So why don't you tell us what you're doing there real quick as well?
Yeah, sure. So we touched on OEMs and rugged devices and dedicated stuff. And that's exactly where I've gone. So I've gone from the MSP doing the implementations of the different EMMs and everything to peeking behind the curtain effectively into seeing how devices themselves are made and the different unique form factors, you know, that you can bring to market. So Social Mobile, the company I work for, specializes in dedicated devices for enterprise, entirely enterprise only, so we don't bring anything for consumers. And it's effectively two routes. You can either go bespoke, so we'll build whatever you want to the requirements that you give us, usually for quite a bit cheaper than the market rate for an equivalent consumer device, just because we don't need to include all of the additional stuff that you wouldn't use with a consumer device. But we're also bringing to market a selection of sort of off-the-shelf devices based on the gaps in the market we've seen. So they're all Android Enterprise. Capable, compatible, zero touch and OEM config supported and all sorts. And
you will personally make sure that they follow best practices.
You've seen my validations, right? I think a few people have seen my. So I'm doing the same stuff I do for everybody else on our own kit just to make sure that, you know, it's got the Baton seal of approval.
Are those like stickers that
we
can
now
put on the device?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll have to get that printed up. And Russ, we know you're on Twitter. You post on LinkedIn sometimes. I know we can also find your stuff at the Mobile Iron blog. But this has been so much fun, Russ. I feel like you're almost like a co-host now. So thank you for this is Russ's idea for putting this together. So this is like podcast number 4, I think, for you. So thank you very much for that. And Jason, it was an absolute pleasure to finally talk on the phone and via video chat. We use the video chat while we're recording our podcast. So this has been really great. Thank you so much to both of you and to everyone for listening. Thank you very much. And let us know you're listening and send us questions and ideas. And until next time, be well and thank you.
Thanks, Jack.